we have removed the difficulty. We have created a kind of child-proof world as much as we can here in the first world. In the other parts of the world, it's anything but. Hard science fiction is a little bit like reality, I suppose. It is, you have to be very deft at cutting out all the dull parts. I think that typically what happens in Hollywood, in media in general, there is a, and I'm not so sure it's an innocent arrogance about the ability of their audiences to come along. And the producer, the executive producer, slaps his hand on the table and says, "That's what we need. We need that mid-course tumble. We need that counter boost. I don't know what it means, but we need it."
we need to get the razzle dazzle.
Yeah, give me the sizzle, but I don't want that steak. Exactly.
Hello and welcome to Culturescape, the show that interviews the geek creators and influencers who built nerd culture. I'm your host, Peter Pischke, and today I have a very special guest for you. His resume is most impressive. He is a distinguished professor of English, a Wall Street Journal bestselling author, a former designer for Games Workshop, a script writer for NPR, PBS, the Discovery Channel. He's collaborated with top scientific organizations and clients such as the Pentagon, the United Nations, and the WHO. He is none other than science fiction author Charles Gannon. Charles is here today to talk to us about the state of the science fiction genre in books, TV, film, and games. He will share his insights on what makes hard sci-fi so different from the rest of the genre and why it is so rare to see proper adaptations on screen. We will discuss his latest book, Protected Species, and his career as a writer. And of course, we will rant about the sad state of pop science fiction franchises. Which brings us to our stupid nerd question of the day. Who is the best and worst Marvel superhero? Charles is most familiar with the MCU, so we'll probably stick to that. And without further ado, welcome to the show, Charles. It's wonderful to have you here today.
It's great to be here. Do you want me to start with the stupid nerd question?
We don't technically start that way, but yeah, we could start with the stupid nerd question. Are you ready to submit your answer? Otherwise, I can go first.
I want a piece of clarification. When you say worst, do you mean the one that you like the least?
You like them the least, or they are the worst put together, they're least interesting. They're just, you know, on a quality of building a character level, like best to worst, not like who is the strongest, you know, like...
No, I just mean appealing or, yeah. So I can start there, actually, probably because no one would expect me to. But I probably would have to go with Captain America, simply because I think Chris Evans... was with the brilliance of the casting of Evans and Downey, particularly those two, is just extraordinary. And I think their chemistry had a lot to do with what the MCU was up through and to the end of Endgame. I have to say that Endgame may have been now for the MCU a bit of a prophetic title. Well, time will tell. I would say the ones I've got to say that the Eternals is just an embarrassment of riches of withered flowers. I would be hard put. I can't remember her name. Why can't I think of her? She's a very famous actress. She played the senior of the gods. I think she turned in a very good performance.
Angelina Jolie, right?
No, that's Athena. This was the one who was playing. Why can't I think of her name? She's Syrian and Mexican. She did that movie on Frida Kahlo, but I can't think of her name right now. At any rate, I think she did a very good job. Everybody else, it's hard to know whether it was the direction, the material, or them, but at some confluence, that was where things kind of broke down for me.
Selma Hayek?
Selma Hayek, yes.
There we go. You shouldn't ask me. I mean, I love entertainment, but I'm just so bad with names. I don't know why. This is how it's always been. I'm almost face blind, not quite face blind, but very close. So my ability to remember names and faces is extremely poor. It always has been. I remember when I was a senior in high school, and we had the new choir teacher who was assistant to the old choir teacher, and she's like, "You know, I had really bothered how you guys don't seem to get along. If you guys really cared about choir, if you really cared about being here, you'd be able to tell us each person in the room their name. And that's what we're going to do today. And I was like, oh no.
Your own private version of hell had come to
you. This is going to go so badly. And it did. I'm not the person to ask about names. The internet has been very, very helpful for that. Okay, so my turn. I think you did a good choice of best character. I do love Captain America. I will go with best put together character. I think Daredevil is a very well put together character. He always has been, especially back at the comics. But even what they've done with the MCU, I guess Netflix doesn't count as the MCU anymore. But that's what I'm thinking of. But he has a very clear power set. His adventures and goals are very set, defined. And even though it's like a smaller setting where he's a street level character, the stories, the pathos, the nuance, the themes are so much larger than the rest of the Marvel's franchise that we've seen on TV and film. You can go back and watch the Netflix series. You get a lot more of that, I think, on an intellectual level necessarily than you will going to the movies, which often are good, but they're not the most thought out. Worst character, I'll have to go with the energy pow-pow shooters. So this is like Captain Marvel, Miss Marvel, any of those characters where their power is like, I shoot CGI, like, you know, just CGI goes out of their fist and it hits the bad guy. I think that is tremendously boring. And Disney did not seem to learn the mistake that comics had made in the early 2010s, because those kind of characters are really hard to attach to. As of yet, they just can't seem to make them work. And I think there's something about that, something about the lack of it being visceral or the lack of connection. Something about that isn't as interesting as coming up to Captain America punching the German dictator in the face. But that's just me.
No, and I think that I find the same thing over on the DC side. Not that I'm not a big comics person, but I've been very interested in what they've done with the movies. I think that, Batman is always, for me, more interesting than Superman, simply because there's something about the sort of deistic scope of power in a character like Superman. Yes, it puts, as you're saying, it sort of puts, it puts them on the horns of all sorts of dilemmas, but they're not the dilemmas that we human beings would experience.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody like Batman, somebody who still is largely, is either an optimized human or just a very skilled human, as the case may be, is a lot more, I think, accessible and a lot more meaningful to us, I think. So I'm kind of, if I'm sort of picking up, if that's some of your vibe, that's certainly one of the things that I felt.
Well, that's a good thing. And I definitely do want to get into your career history because it is very unique and interesting. But this is something, you do a lot of hard science fiction, which is a genre that I do enjoy. But it's not some that you see very often that escapes the world of books. You see it even more, I think, in video games necessarily than you do in like TV and film. I kind of wonder like why it is. I asked you earlier about some of your favorite franchises before we recorded, and you were saying The Expanse is one that you really enjoy. That's considered, in terms of science fiction, to be more realistic. But even then, that's not really hard science fiction. So what do you think it is? Why is it so hard for hard sci-fi, you know, really well thought out sci-fi, to escape its niche?
First of all, I think Hollywood is intrinsically suspicious of it. I think it's an example of that, and this is something that I feel fairly safe saying, having worked in television. Part of what I did in television, the film part of my career, was actually as a script doc back in the mid 80s and early 80s. So I date myself. But just even when, for instance, I was one of the, I wound up being a consultant for, and then became on air talent for, Discovery, When Aliens Attack. It was the second or third of their, of the Discovery channels. I can't remember what that series is they had.
Is it Curiosity?
Curiosity. Thank you very much.
Yes. Wikipedia made me right in the end. There we go.
Okay,
thank you.
There you go. So one of the things that we were trying to tell them, they brought in hard SF people. I won't go through the names because I'm not sure how meaningful they'll be to your audience, but people who were very well regarded in that field and had quite a history in it. And to give you the state of play without naming any names, this story tells you why. I think Hollywood, whatever the media are, have a hard time with it. So they said, well, how would they get here? Why would they be here? And then how do we make it real? How do we make this sort of, you know, that it's not just magic? And I said, well, I think you'd want to do this. And I mentioned what a conventional transit would be like if you're going slower than light. And they didn't know what to do with that. So I got up at a whiteboard and I drew the picture up. Here's a craft. It boosts to mid-course tumble. Mid-course tumble stabilizes counter thrust to achieve zero arrival in the system. And the producer, the executive producer, slaps his hand on the table and says, that's what we need. We need that mid-course tumble. We need that counter boost. I don't know what it means, but we need it. I kid you not. That is pretty much a verbatim quote.
we need to get the razzle dazzle.
Yeah, give me the sizzle, but I don't want that steak. Exactly. And this is happening at Discovery Channel, trying to do something that is about as believable as a scenario you can, and they ditch it because they felt it was too hard to understand. I actually think they're wrong. I think that typically what happens in Hollywood, in media in general, is that and I'm not so sure it's an innocent arrogance about the ability of their audiences to come along. I think that audiences actually very often like being challenged a little bit. Not too much, but a little bit. And mm-hmm. I think anybody who turns into curiosity was kind of pre-selected in a sense. It wasn't like, you know, it was inside of Discovery. So clearly there would be a higher sort of bar of accountability that would be there. And yet that's what happened. And I think that is a diagnostic of a disease that is rampant in most of our media, which is in when I was in television, there was something that got confused with liquid crystal diodes, LCD, lowest common denominator. And back in, for instance, back in broadcast days, the idea was that no primetime show could be aimed, the maximum degree of, if you will, a challenge that it would represent to an audience member would be somebody who would be a B- average in high school. That was the terms that were used back in the days when I and roamed the earth with dinosaurs. And so that was, I think that's still out there. And unfortunately, no one has ever gone impoverished by going with that calculus for whatever reason. I wish they would, but they haven't yet.
That is an interesting point you bring up, because I would say most of those properties, like Discovery Channel, they've gone way below your B- average
they
student.
Sure,
I mean, they're
have.
Like maybe they graduated like an inner city California high school. Maybe they didn't. You know that, but that we're that's the 10 years ago. I've talked about this on my show before, but the stunt Discovery Channel did for Good Morning America. In fact, I think it was across all the morning channels, was a man who's going to be swallowed alive by a giant snake. Yes, the man that's going to be swallowed by a python. That was the event. And that was pretty much at that. I was like, yes, we now have crossed the idiocracy threshold. We've done it.
That's sideshow stuff. I mean, you know, that. That is one of the reasons I think so. I think when it comes to hard science fiction in general, though, a lot of what happens in space, particularly, is very counterintuitive. You're heading towards a planet. How do you get further away from it? At a certain point, you do it by actually accelerating, which, because of the orbital mechanics, actually pushes you up out. Now, if you're heading straight down, that won't help you at all. That'll just make a bigger crater when you hit. But it's there are just a whole lot of counterintuitive things like that. A lot of things that, for instance, you don't even touch, not even the Expanse touches them. No one has touched them. For instance, if you are in space, if you're in a rotating habitat, there'd be something called Coriolis effect. Your inner ear is used to being on a planet that's rotating. I mean, the miles per hour are slow, but the RPM is one for every 24 hours. That is absolutely no destabilization to us. a mile wide, a mile diameter space station going at 1 RPM will give you 1G equivalent, but that's 1 revolution per minute. And that is at the threshold. When you start getting into 5 RPM, 7 RPM, things like this, the inner ear starts going wonky. Our eyes don't match up with our proprioception. All sorts of things start going haywire. I think that in general, now that may not sound very exciting, and maybe it isn't. I actually think you could make exciting things, or you know, not a week. That's not going to work week to week, but a one-time thing that can be kind of interesting. But in general, hard science fiction is a little bit like reality, I suppose. You have to be very deft at cutting out all the dull parts. Uh-huh. And there are a lot of dull parts. You don't get places as fast as we see in Star Wars or you know, things like that, which gets into other issues, but I'll leave it at that. But that's, I think, one of the reasons why. And because now we get back to that story I told. When the executive producer didn't even understand what we were telling him, and this was pretty basic, That I think is kind of a narrow pipe of what, if it doesn't pass their smell test, they're not going to let it through. So to some extent, the aperture of what they can get their heads around, or are willing to get their heads around, is going to determine the maximum, you know, of what comes out the other end, and that's not particularly big.
It's interesting, this caveat. So my dad is a child of the 60s, and he grew up reading a lot of the science fiction magazines from the 60s, but stories that had been collated from before. If you go back to those stories, you know, science fiction from like the 30s or 60s, hard sci-fi was, I wouldn't say it was the most popular genre, but it was near the top, and people were very much interested. It's fascinating if you listen to like old science fiction radio shows. You turn on X-1, you hear a story written in the 30s. And there's so many scientific concepts, like what is the moon about? You know, could we settle there? What would it take to get there? All these big questions. And they're so interesting, and they're such a mystery, and it engages with the audience. It's cheesy to say, it's a little corny, but I think those stories of the past, even from the radio shows from back in the day, did seem to understand the majesty and interest in the world of science. It's like, This is the fundamental building blocks of how the universe works. And this is why, if we could learn to understand it, we could do so much more. You know, we could meet all these amazing goals that we have. And today, it's sad to say, but that interest just isn't quite there the same in the popular zeitgeist. And I don't know if that's a problem with us. Is that because we have the internet and cable and Netflix on demand, and we just have too many distractions, so we don't appreciate something like, you know, how do you send a shuttle on the moon, you know, and you have to break it up into all these different stages of pieces, and what do you have to do, and you can't have so much weight that you can only, you know, when you land on the moon, the thing can only actually be a little thing made of aluminum foil because you run out of weight. That stuff like that is like super interesting, but today, I don't know what is wrong with us. Maybe it's TV. Maybe it's celebrity. I don't know. Something is different because we just do not have that same appreciation as those that came before.
And that's a whole nother episode of your show, I think. And I'll be happy to come back for it.
Because
really, as you say, and I think zeitgeist is a really important and in our culture underused word. But again, it's difficult. Whoops. I think a lot of things coalesce around that. But I think one of the key things is that people have said 1984 is the dangerous. That is the chilling dystopic version. I was never that fearful of 1984. 1984 is a tremendous absolute, and basically the can't remember the guy's name, O'Brien, who is the tormentor of our the protagonist, says, do you want to know what the future is? And he says, envision a boot endlessly stomping down into a human face. Then you go to Brave New World, Brave New World is not about coercion. Brave New World is about essentially co-option through seduction. There is a scene very early on in the book where somebody says, where the world controller, Mustafa Mond, says that the unfulfilled gratification is the deepest threat to stability. In other words, people need to get what they want as quickly as we can get it to them. And of course, that's why Shakespeare and art is so dangerous, because it is the drama of it is the things that we want, that we're constantly struggling between what are the stakes and what are the costs? What are we going to do? What are we willing to sacrifice? What corners are we willing to cut? What risks are we willing to take? They have done everything they can to eliminate that in Brave New World. And if you take everything you're saying, whether it's TV, whether it's internet, we have removed the difficult. We have created a kind of child-proof world as much as we can here in the first world. In the other parts of the world, it's anything but.
Yes.
And I think it's that combination of things, which means all the things you're talking about. You know, how did Kennedy sell the moon? We will do these things. We will do these and the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. That almost sounds absurd to the sensibilities, I think, of the more immediate generations. Why would you do that? And I think however we got from there to here, I think might be the answer to your question.
So your career has been really interesting. I think it ties into some of this. So you have worked in all kinds of part of writing. You worked at Games Workshop as a writer designer there back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. You worked as a scriptwriter for productions like PBS Discovery. You have done and still do consultancy work for big important things like the United Nations. So you've been all over the gamut.
I haven't done anything, just to correct, I haven't done anything for the United Nations since, I would say, the late 80s.
Okay.
It's been more the five-sided squirrel cage and the beltway and things like that. More recently.
The Pentagon. The Pentagon.
Yes. Yes.
Is that a common descriptor for the Pentagon?
That five-sided squirrel cage and the five-sided puzzle box.
Awesome.
Depends how you feel in a given day.
Well, I think of Games Workshop, you know, you make this point about it's not necessarily the writers, it's what's happened to the audience. Games Workshop is even, you know, you see this at Games Workshop, you see this on the other side of the coast with Wizards of the Coast and D&D, where they've gone to a place where the bigger rules, the more, you know, the better you could get the players to jump into this universe and really engage with the mechanics of it, the better. To now we have, in today, it's like, let's dumb this down as much as is possible. We want the person to come in with zero literacy, just the lowest intellectual level we could possibly take our customers. That's what we're aiming for. That's why we're going to do, you know, today's new module of Dungeons & Dragons, the coffee shop. You know, let's go to the mall. And it's painful because I think of, like, you, if you're working at Games Workshop, you know, especially back in the heyday, that stuff's pretty, that's pretty hardcore. That's juicy. You can sink your teeth into it. Whereas I think the stuff being put out today by places like Games Workshop is like, it's just so thin. It's not going to hold your interest very long.
Games Workshop is not the same thing as Game Designers Workshop. GDW actually went out of business in 1993. The Games Workshop is in England. And they,
yes.
You think of Warhammer and stuff like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, GDW. Is the folks that were behind Traveler, 2300 AD. They made a huge amount of money doing source books, fact books for Gulf War I, because they have and had real chops for technology and military application protocol, you know, training and doctrine, all that.
Okay, so I got that wrong. So, yes, it is Games Design Workshop. I for some reason, my brain read Games Workshop. It just cut out the design.
You and about 70% of other people.
That's my fault. You know, I cheated for today to write up my summary. I went to the Tales of the Terran Republic wiki, and this thing has not served me well. I've gotten a whole lot of things today wrong, and I usually get a few things wrong, but this is bad. It's funny that I'm talking about people who I think are like intellectually below me. Oh, you know, oh, those dunces. And I'm like, I'm getting every single thing part of this interview wrong. That's amazing.
Look, we do a lot of this. The flip side, the positive side, is that when I was writing for GDW, so we go back now to the late 80s through to about 1992, 93, we hadn't won yet. You know, the science fiction and fantasy was, from a literary standpoint and a media standpoint, in the ghetto right next to pornography, really. This was not something you generally did openly. You know, there's a famous English author who loved reading science fiction, but always had a newspaper so he could hide the book on the underground when he was going back and forth from his day job. And I think it's a natural consequence of what happens when you win. We have so much stuff. No one can keep up with it. You know, it's impossible. So I actually think it's kind of amazing that you only got these, as far as I'm concerned, are tiny details. These are not so castigating yourself in public here. No, Peter, you've done your homework and you've done it well.
Thanks.
Sure.
You are right, though. I mean, this is something we noticed in the last... So comic books, which I don't know if you have any interest in, one of the things we've seen recently is the industry is completely imploded. It's like, you know, everyone could see it. It was kind of like after the fall of Marvel movies, and people could see just, you know, okay, so how is comics doing? Because people aren't interested in the MCU. So how is comics doing? And it turns out not very well. So we've seen a huge, huge implosion. It's just, you know, how an implosion works. It gets really big and then deflates. And it's like a empty basketball, you know, it looks sad and limpy. And one of the things that's come out of this is we've had these comic book creators, the people who have been in charge the last decade, last 15 years. And it's very clear to everyone paying attention what a low opinion they have of their audience. And one of them said outright, like, this is a class thing to them. They think the readers is in a different class, that, you know, we deign to have them read our stories. And I see that kind of attitude way too often in popular fiction today, or at least these industries where people write these stories. And it's really sad because I pull from, you know, because I grew up in the 2000s and the early 2010s, and I pull from that time where it's not quite socially acceptable to it, but there's this big culture with so much breadth that is being a nerd, and it's so deep, and you could just really dive into it. And it's gone from, yeah, you would be attacked and made fun of, but you had this, and you just had this special kind of community, this special place you could do. And it's gone from that where it's gone to the mainstream. But by going in the mainstream, they want to divvy it out. You know, it's more shallow. It's been, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't know.
Diluted?
Diluted. Thank you. Diluted. And to me, it's interesting, but also kind of sad. I do have to wonder, though, that as people do realize that, hey, these industries don't seem to have a very high opinion of their audience, if we're now going to get more people going back to places like Bane Books, like the projects that you've been working on, and it will go there. I mean, you have this new book that just came out, and you have quite a few titles now to your name. Are you seeing growth in science fiction? Do you think there's a new audience coming to these stories?
So just to go back to the issue of, you know, the problems with winning, right? That you're no longer in the ghetto. You may be familiar, but probably not all your viewers are, simply because there's so much media out there, it's easy to miss things. In my day, there was so little. There were so few movies, you saw almost all of them, you know, and the screen was alive with things that had been produced 10, 15, 20, 30 years before, because there were a lot of hours to fill up. Now we're on the other side of the equation, and I could tell you a story about that and being in television in the 80s, and you could see it coming. You could just see it coming, that this production explosion that we've had was inevitable in essence. But there's a movie, I forget, with the Marx Brothers, and it's, I forget which one it is, but about this thing you're saying about, you know, that it was in, there were certain things when the community was perhaps a little bit isolated, or even you know, was looked down upon, but it had greater cohesion. And there's a moment where Groucho Marx says, "I never want to belong to a club that would have me as a member."
And that's a nice impression.
Yeah. Well, it's no, I do a better John F. Kennedy, actually. But it's, that's something that I think that there's something to be said for that. You know, when you become dominant, it's almost like you begin to prey upon your own, and different things begin to emerge in that. I guess what I mean is that inside of sub-communities, there may be a pecking order. That's kind of a human nature thing. But there's also a sense of, yeah, but it's us, and then there's all of them. And that always sort of has a tendency to create a cohesion around what I would call the periphery of contact with mainstream and the sub-community. When the sub-community becomes the mainstream, the competition is now inside. And that, I think it almost doesn't matter what it, because you now, there's actually a lot to be gained from being the top dog in the mainstream, right? That's a kind of fringe position, as long as you're a sub-community. When the sub-community becomes the main community, the same dynamics will tend to arise, I think, no matter what the definition of the community is, how it defines itself, because it's human nature to compete more and more, and that means exclude more and more, the bigger the prizes. And we are in a place now where, well, as anybody, I'm sure you know this, you'll know these numbers better than I, but the number of top grossing movies that have science fictional or fantastic elements to them, and not just in the past year, not in the past decade or two, has been, it's like an asymptotic growth curve. I mean, if you have a fantastic element, you stand a better than average chance pulling in enough people just on the curiosity level. As long as you keep your production values down, production costs down, and the MCU has apparently forgotten about that a little.
Yeah, definitely.
But in terms of, is there an audience for it? Yes, there is. I think the audience has never gone away. I think the audience is very self-selecting. I think a lot of my readers are people who have always marched to a particular, the beat of a particular drum. And when and if the mainstream of society tends to align itself more with that drum beat, it's not like they're going to march away. They're not contrarian by nature. But if it changes away or goes too far in the other direction, or it doesn't change them very much. I think there are always going to be, look, as long as we have a society where things have to run and things have to operate, there have got to be people who are saying, yeah, but bottom line, you know, what are the numbers saying? What is the received wisdom of people who've done this for a long time, even if the tech is changing it somewhat? People like that, I think, are always going to like science fiction. Science fiction is very popular amongst engineers. Engineers either have no use for it because their attitude is, yeah, but it's not real. It's like, well, you're missing the point, but okay, that tells me you just don't like that speculative part of it. But those who have a speculative tendency, you're going to find a lot of people at the engineering and technologist level who are very, very fond of science fiction, and it doesn't much change. So I think there's hope. Is it a new audience? Ask me another 5 years.
Fair. I remember one time when I was serving on my mission back in the day, and we knocked at the house of this guy, and I could see through his window he's watching Star Trek SG-1. And I... Sorry, Star DS9. Gate. There we go. Yeah, no,
oh,
not
no,
Stargate.
Okay.
Star Trek.
It
Star Trek DS9.
It was,
yeah,
Star Trek.
Different mixed acronym of letters and numbers.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, hey, you know, I see that you're watching that, you know, because I like sci-fi. He's like, oh, yeah. He says, you know, all anyone that's in news, they really like sci-fi. And I think that is true. I think the mistake we've made is that science fiction, great literature, it tries to take an audience to aspire to be something more. And I think the sad caveat of today, if I look even at what's happening with, you know, some of my favorites, like Doctor Who, they've made the mistake of thinking that instead of trying to inspire the audience to be more, you know, this is the best of us, this is the ideal, let's tell the very best stories we can with the best people we can, you know, let's really astound and amaze. And they says, no, all these shows, all these movies, they have to reflect to the audience. We're essentially taking these properties and we're bringing them down to their level without understanding that they are taking out that inspirational aspect to it. And yeah, going back to even stuff that you do, hard science fiction does really well. It says, it doesn't say, here's a good story, but it says that there is this chance that if we could understand these things, this could be real. And that is a huge appeal. That's a huge appeal. That's why I love hard sci-fi or like near future science fiction, because it says, like, look, if we could understand how the building blocks of the universe work, we have all these mechanisms, we understand them, and we can build with them, this world of tomorrow is within our grasp. It's aspiring us to be more, to do more. And I think the sad thing is to the stuff we have today, it's not telling us that. It's saying, no, actually stay where you are. It's comfortable. It's all right here. stop complaining about your neighbors. That's sad to me because I think I'm listening to a science fiction Doctor Who book that was written in the 70s. And it's like, even from the people, we're getting the last gasp of the people who are the magazine writers in the 60s. It's like there is this inspirational tone. It's so, once you get it, you know, you haven't had it for a while. And I've been watching a lot of terrible, trashy pop science fiction stuff. And then I go back and I listen to this. And it's like, there's something about it. It's nutritional. It's nutritious. It's not just, this doesn't just taste good. It's not just McDonald's, but it's actually good for me. And that, I think, is the major difference. How you would change that, I just don't know. I think it's what you're doing. It's saying, well, hey, these people are doing it and they have an audience. And I don't know if the people who are in Hollywood can necessarily understand that, you know, instead of just trying to take it and make it into McDonald's like they do, if they could understand, oh, actually, we want to serve, I don't know, what's a healthy food chain? Subway? We want to serve Subway. So Subway is what we want to do. Not McDonald's. Subway. But that might be just too difficult, like the producer you described at the start of this intro.
And I was about to say, I think the thing is that Hollywood and film tends not to be, they're frequently seen as breaking trends, right? They're setting trends. No, they generally, what has happened, and this is the case of fashion in general, somebody tries it who has less at stake. Somebody sees it with a much higher, from a much higher funding or power position and says, that I'm going to get behind that. They're all of a sudden the trendsetter. They're generally not the innovator. The innovation comes from someplace else. I find it very interesting that, for instance, even the Science Fiction Channel, as I'm sure you know, was going to let Expanse go. But it took a billionaire who actually has a rocket program of his own, you know, Bezos, to say, no, we're gonna fund that. We're going to see that thing through. I think that I don't know that what I'm doing will work. I don't have any grandiose vision of myself. I do feel this. I feel that there's a job to do, and the job is to inspire. I think that it is important to acknowledge where we've had things wrong, where there have been inequities. But if you look at my science fiction, you're going to find, I think people can sometimes feel a little bit like they're not sure where their footing is, and I'll tell you why. There were a lot of, I love the science fiction also of the 40s, the 50s, the 60s. I would say that it also shows the warts of those times as well. There were all sorts of inequities, which were just fine, you know?
There's plenty of racism, sexism. Yeah. You can find that.
Yeah. But I kind of feel that what happened is the baby went out. That was supposed to be changed. The as in change the inequities, absolutely. But that does not mean lose sight of the inspiration. The question is, how do you write something that's inspiring and yet believable? And I'll give you an example of one of the ways in which I've done it in the very book you're reading. It becomes very obvious, although it's actually not mentioned there, but it's starting to come to the fore. I had somebody ask me, you know, why race didn't play something, you know, play a larger card. And I said, well, you see people of color all the time, but it's not broken out. You know, you eventually realize it in the course of a character description as you would any place else. And it's because to them, that's gone. That's if I am really trying to project, I will never say predict. Prediction is a fool's game. Projection is, to me, the value of it. It's the thought experiment. To put it along with Zeitgeist, the Gedanken experiment. And for me, there's bigotry, but the bigotry is different. The bigotry in this, in the future I'm writing about, which is about 100 years from now, in the 2080s or a little bit before, you had a lot of people who were using all sorts of electronic, everything from really souped up pacemakers. There were a whole lot of medical, insertions into the body, some for performance, most for life extension. There was just a whole lot of that stuff going on. The only problem was at a certain point, there was something called the empidemic, EMP, because two things happened. They were hacked, and there was also electromagnetic pulses, which disabled them. Now, what that did was it put more emphasis on genetics as a way to optimize. So you have two genetic rough approaches, and this is coming at it today. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Gattaca.
Yes, an excellent movie back from the 90s. Yes.
Yeah, good. A really, really good movie, because one of the things that it does, which you don't hear spoken about right now, is it preserves the quality control component of evolution. The individuals being produced through Gattaca are, you take the same natural gametes and you clone those, and you see a thousand, you take the best out of a thousand, right? That gives you all sorts of non-intrusive use of best genetic choicing between that. That is very expensive, though, because to create a sample size large enough to pull a notably better variety, you're going to have to create a lot of zygotes that you can, eggs that you are fertilized over that you can actually sample from. What's the next tier down? CRISPR. CRISPR is essentially cutting into genes with the equivalent of genetic, you know, genetic shears. There's a couple of problems with CRISPR, and this is, I project that they're worse than we know today, because we really don't understand one thing about CRISPR. CRISPR, we can see a one-to-one relationship with genes, right? This gene does that gene does this. This is the one for hemophilia, we're going to cut that out. This is Tay-Sachs, we're going to cut that out. Da 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 da. Well, we don't know, as we do that and then make eye colors for eye, choice for eye colors, height, et cetera, is what sort of epigenetic connections are we scissoring out? Because those aren't one for one. Epigenetics are, if you will, kind of free-floating chemical relationships between the gene code. You start cutting into those, you may get things you don't expect. But that's still expensive for everybody to do. So now we get into the part of the world that can't afford the Gattaca model and can't afford the CRISPR model. What do they do? Well, they want to be able to compete. So if they have to take a loan to get a cybernetic eye, to get a cybernetic arm, to get a replacement this, an augmented that, they will. But it means that somebody owns them. And it means that therefore they are innately suborned. And what happens is there's the bigotry in this century forward is what your origin was. Did you come from one of the countries where that's the way? You have to ensure, you know, a better chance for yourself and for your family? Or did you come from one of the wealthy nations which mostly subsidizes the Gattaca method, which is all the best that evolution ever had to offer? You know, just you need a thousand swings to hit a home run, and almost anybody can at that point. And so that is where the bigotry really is, because you hear that somebody, let's say, has come from Myanmar. You go, can I trust you? You're in a, you know, because if you are performing at a high enough level, what do I not know about how you perform? And of course, humans are humans. So the bigotry is not, I will only become bigoted when and if I know you have something in you that actually makes you subornable to a mega corporation or a government or something like that. Or do I just say, you're one of those? It's a very, very human tendency. And so you might say that what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to, if people have said, well, I'd like to see more about race. My attitude is, if we are still where we are right now, if we haven't made significant transformative progress about race in 100 years, that we're not talking about the future I'm writing about. That's a very different future. And I think it's a future with some real difficulties with inspiration. How do we not get better in 100 years? There's lots of people writing that. I want to write about something that we got past that. But the strange thing is, the bear of bigotry is always waiting further down the cave. This is a human issue that we will be contending for, I'm sorry to say, the foreseeable future. We just have to, the challenge is to do better, to get over the next hurdle. There'll be another one, but the more hurdles you go over, hopefully the better you get at hurdling.
I mostly agree with what you had there. I believe that the issues of the problem of human nature will always be with us. Maybe not the specific ones, but there's usually something. I think that is completely correct. So I know that we're getting tight in time. I wanted to ask you, what are your fears or hopes with AI? We're seeing tremendous change in the world of media, of tech. The things that artificial intelligence, especially stuff, you know, like ChatGPT, that we are seeing and how it's impacting things is huge. I know in the news business, it's gutting the news business. Google's basically trying to cut out the news publishers altogether. It's affecting education in huge ways. Entertainment production, I mean, anything that really that requires writing. Do you have a fear that AI will affect your industry, or what are you doing? Do you think it's a positive? Because you do write about hard science fiction, so you do think about these things. What are your feelings on AI as it stands now? Is this a good change, a negative change? Where are you?
I'm in a position that has elements of both. I do think that it's going to change our industry. It already is changing. I think one of the things is that we've been talking about readers for the last 15 years as though all readers are the same. The bottom line is, and I'm not saying anything negative about this, I'm just drawing a line between, there are two very different kinds of consumers out there, and I'm going to take extreme versions, okay? There are people who, if a book comes out by a given author, they don't even stop to see what it's about. They like that author's voice. They like what that author does. They want to go and they want to experience that. There are, and you can find this all over Amazon, all over Reddit, all over the chat boards. There are folks who say, I actually want my Lit RPG, I'll just choose that, but they could be put anything in, but Lit RPG, as folks who are very, very articulate, I would say, about what they want. What they want is, I want to be in that world. I actually kind of like having the game mechanics in the book, and I really don't care if the prose is, and if the person isn't really quite well versed in punctuation. Or is a little bit lazy when it comes to eliminating repetition or character. I don't care. This is what I want. I know what I want. Who's to say they're wrong? Who's to say the other one is right? They're not. But AI is not going to be able to duplicate that voice. Now, that actually, but that doesn't mean that I think that the reader, that author is safe. Actually, potentially not, in a very, very profound way. Here's why. anything that can be done according to like a recipe or a template or a module, AI is going to do that, and it's going to do it well. And if what you don't need is what I would call innovation or surprise, because that's what AI is very bad at, surprise. You know, it can only look at what surprises humans and mimic. It doesn't understand hope. It does not understand tragedy. AI can only essentially recook a joke, reformulate a joke that it's already heard. The thing is, how often, you know, there's a reason why a joke is only funny once, you know, because it's surprise. That, whatever it is in an author that makes their voice singular, surprising, engaging, I don't think an AI can do. But that doesn't mean that most readers aren't actually going to find themselves perfectly well served by something that is written to a pretty high level on a template. And I think in the final analysis, you're talking about McDonald's. I think that AI could be serving most of what I'm going to call tight subgenre targeted reading audiences pretty well. And for those who just really want to live in that world, you know, who want to binge almost more than they care about it's not like they don't care about quality at all, but their desire to binge in a place they like is almost as high as the threshold of what they're willing to, you know, of the minimum performance they see in it in terms of, is it engaging? Is it innovative? Is it all of those things. In the process, you were talking earlier about the fact that our narratives have become, how would I put it? It's almost as if there's a teleology in them, in that what you say is almost, what you wind up saying and formulating as a statement is almost more important than the quality of the story or the believability of the characters. Yes. Or anything else like that.
Hard to agree. Extent,
yeah. To the extent that that you want something that is the main publishers are going to want to go where the money is. They've already been losing money because they have to some degree compromised whatever balance they've struck between quality and statement has cost them money. It's pretty clear it's cost them money. They're already sitting on a kind of deficit in terms of what's going on with our market share. If AI comes along and allows them to get books out with minimum expenses to writers in terms of paying writers, hiring writers, et cetera, if they can do it with showrunners and the AI can do most of the work, I think you're going to see a lot of money moving in that direction. The question is this, that would be like building a McDonald's, going to your model on every corner, which it sounds great until you've had your 98th straight day of being restricted to the McDonald's menu, which doesn't change very much. So now you go down the street and you say, I want chicken fried steak. I want bouillabaisse. I want something new. How many of those restaurants will still be open? And that's the danger, I think, to the writers who are serving a niche, what will become, I think, a narrow niche for a while, but they'll come back to it. And those are the writers who work by surprise. They don't work to formula. They understand that the key to a great narrative is the surprise, that we are stunned by hope. We're stunned by tragedy. We cry, we laugh, we gasp. AI texts tend not to do that. Will the writers who can do that, the humans who can do that, because those are all human traits that we humans innately understand and can produce, that an AI can only mimic. If it goes on long enough that AI pulls enough of the money before somebody says, tear down some of those McDonald's. I want a restaurant. I want a Mexican restaurant, for crying out loud. I want a French restaurant. I want something like that. You could watch, I think, a lot of people in my shoes unable to support themselves in this crap. That's where I think it'll shift back. I don't think the human voice is doomed, but I think the oil tanker will move in one direction, or could move in one direction and then move in a back over. But in the process, I think a lot of careers could be very, very bad. I think that's the worst case scenario, but it's one that I would love to see us avoid.
It's worth considering. I know the world of news is hurting a ton in that way. I know comics, that's where they've been now for a while. But to your other point, that means in a world where AI is able to churn out paint-by-numbers, kind of science fiction or storytelling, the person that has a more unique voice, that's even in previously, that maybe they didn't feel it was as competent, but it was just different, those are the kind of people I think who will get some advantage of this world we're going into. But I take your concerns to heart. I have the same thing in my industry. It is a worry. So like, how many people can realistically do this besides people who have a lot of money and so they could just dedicate themselves to it, or they're doing it basically almost like a hobby?
Yeah, and anybody who already has a name is more likely to survive. It will be a very, very bad time for people who are just coming in and trying to be heard, because I think a lot of folks who are, as more and more people drop away, there's going to be a tendency, and I turned this off, so I have no idea why this is doing that. I turned this phone off.
It's okay. You re-say your statement. You're okay.
I have to sort of completely retarget myself. It's a situation where there is erosion of what I will call human writers is going to be a very hard one for writers who are just getting started or whose names are not, they don't already have a following. A following is going to tend to get in line and sort of almost protectively, I think, get around that voice. And as more people drop away, you're going to have fewer of those clusters. And I think the clusters will work as magnets. But what it's going to do is it will tend to, I think, really, there's going to be a tough period.
Yeah, I agree. I see it in news. It's like, oh, isn't this great? AI is going to get rid of all the busy work, you know? No one's going to have to do the press release write-up. No one's going to have to do with, oh, here are the sports numbers for the day. But it's like those are the kind of jobs that you would give interns or people who are starting so they could get into the industry to climb the ladder. If you eliminate those, how does someone start climbing the ladder? You know, you see this a ton in superhero comics or films or TV where it's on street level in New York. And there's this, you know, they have the stairs of the apartment, the metal railing. It's like 10 feet above you. And you're still like, you have to almost have superpowers to grab it and pull it down. It's kind of like that. It's like you've cut off the bottom few rungs of the ladder and now no one could actually grab it. Well, it's great for the people who are already on the ladder, but you're going to have a problem in the future of a talent deficit.
I think that's a very, very insightful and unfortunately very likely phenomenon. Let's just hope that... I think it's my attitude is I'm not intrinsically a doomsayer. As a matter of fact, quite the contrary. But I do believe that it is best to be prepared for the worst so that things are better. Generally, that just leaves you in that much better of a position. So
true. I'm a realist myself. I understand. Well, and on that depressing note, by the way, the chicken fried steak of science fiction and pop entertainment, that would be Warhammer 40K. Those people are insane, but they keep coming back for it. I love them. They're crazy.
They do. They do indeed.
Do you have final thoughts? Do you have anything else you'd like to share with the audience?
I've really enjoyed this. I would like to give a plug for hard SF in general. I also write fantasy. One of the things I think that for me is very important is, most of the people who like, as a matter of fact, I have yet to find anybody who likes my fantasy that doesn't like my science fiction, vice versa. And I think a lot of that has to do with rigor. It has to do with accountability. If you have a world, does it make sense and does it follow its own rules? Which is, by the way, one of the things that I think going back to where we started in a sense. Is what makes science fiction hard SF on TV and film so difficult because, for instance, how they got the transporter in Star Trek, right?
I would love to hear this story. I think I have heard this one before, but you can tell.
So originally, you may remember, and in the first season, they would go down to the planet with the shuttlecraft, right? And then the shuttlecraft would get, there'd be ionic storms and this, you know, whatever they were going with. But the problem was that they were running into the issue that if you could only have, it was so expensive to do the model work in those days that it was going to break the bank if they kept on, you know, having to need more different, scenes of this. And that by the middle of the first season, it's like, ho-hum, it's the stock footage of the shuttle again. Because when the shuttle goes out, it's always the exact same star field, always the exact same angle. And they said, this is not working. I know what we can do. We can have a teleporter. It'll beam people down. It'll break up. And of course, there was a lot of value to that in the sense, because can you imagine McCoy without being able to be his curmudgeonly self of griping about having his, you know, atoms ripped apart and reassembled, you know, someplace else? He was this sort of, it actually put a kind of Luddite, almost Luddite pause in this view of tomorrow that was kind of a reassuring thing in a way. It suggested that here was this future, but there were compromises. And the number of times that, of course, then you get on the other side, which is, quite frankly, in the real world, talking about, this is what I mean by accountable. Do I believe the teleporters is realistic? You'd have to be able to do a lot of things a lot better than they do. And it ultimately gets them into trouble, because then by the time you get from the teleporter to the holodeck, right, where you can make things, scarcity disappears logically. And what is your economy? And you get into what I consider the sort of disaster zone of an implausible utopia of the next generation. It just doesn't work for me at all. Next generation was not my cup at all. So you got that, but then you have the additional unreality of this. I ask you to think of any system on which so many lives depend, which malfunctions so often and so easily as the teleporter. It would have been yanked in 18 months of service and they'd have gone back to the shuttle. But, you know, these are the things we forgive because of good storytelling and inspiration. And that's the note I'll end.
Okay, that works. I like the teleporter, that because it's a wonderful thought experiment.
It is. Really is.
Okay, well, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show today, Charles. I really appreciate it.
I'm Chuck.
You prefer going by Chuck?
Absolutely.
Not Charles?
Yep.
You're a Chuck person? Okay, Chuck.
Yeah, I am.
Yeah. I don't know if I meet a lot of people who are proud Chuck goers these days.
Probably one of the reasons that I use it.
Makes you unique.
Well, also that, it's like, I don't know, doctors, Charles, I feel, is one of those names, which for whatever reason, very often puts people a little distance. And I'll keep that as on my books, because it's how I started out. And I keep it for legal reasons. If there's a relationship that might be a little bit transactional, I'll lead with that. But as soon as I know people, I want them to just, you know, we're just folks. I'm just Chuck.
Does your family call you Chuck? Are you Charles at home and then Chuck outside?
Well, I've Chuck to my wife. And I'm dad to my kids. I don't hold with first names for parents. That does not go down in this household. I'm telling you.
On that note.
Because you know those families. You know
those.
Yeah,
I know. I know. I have my sister's like that. I understand. Yeah.
I ain't.
Okay, and on that note, we're going to end it here, guys. Thank you so much for taking the time to watch today. Be sure to check out Chuck's books. They are most excellent, all of them. There's not really a bad one I've read. Not that I've read his entire catalog, but everything I have read is pretty good, which that's my endorsement right there. So check it out. Thank you to Bain Books Publishing for helping put this together, an imprint of Simon & Schuster, and of course, Young Voices, a journalism advocacy organization. I'm your host, Pete Pischke. Thanks again to my editor, Chris Holowicki, who makes me look way more competent than I actually am. And it's truer in this episode than many. And thank you, friends, for taking the time to watch. Until next time, keep geeking out.